This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and we're talking about peace because someone has to, and we think it's important. Glad you're listening. Today, on this half-hour version of our program, two interviews. In a few minutes, former intelligence officer Ray McGovern talks about presidents and peacemaking in his 23 years of preparing briefings for the White House, and about a 1928 effort to make war illegal. But first, Dr. Gary Slutkin, an epidemiologist who, after working for years trying to control multiple epidemics in Africa, returned to the U.S. and started to consider what people were calling an epidemic, a violence epidemic, in his home of Chicago. He eventually founded Cure Violence, a non-governmental organization that attempts to treat violence like an infectious disease. And he tells us what happened and how it's working out. If you're interested in this, head to our website to hear either the hour-long version of our program that has more from both of our guests, or our entire original interviews with each guest. Right now, here's Gary Slutkin talking with me about the Cure Violence program, now being tried in various locales around the world, saying it was maps and graphs that were charting the spread of violence in Chicago that sent him on his way to this new approach of how to reduce violence in our cities.
They were appearing to me just as the same types of maps and figures and graphs that I'd been viewing for so many years, looking at the spread of cholera or the spread of TB or AIDS. They're just the same type of clustering, the same type of waveforms. So it seemed familiar. I was a little surprised by that, actually.
So with those maps and graphs looking so familiar, tell me about how you began to frame the treatment plan around the pillars used to treat infectious diseases. You added components that maybe intuitively people wouldn't think would work on limiting violence.
Well, besides the figures and the maps and so on, we were doing a lot of other research as to what had worked and to try to figure out some of the characteristics of violence in populations. And there's this one other piece of the puzzle, which was when asking, what is the greatest predictor of violence, of a violent event? The answer was a preceding violent event. And that kind of really hit the nail on the head, because that's, also exactly the situation with flu or with TB or colds even. So it became clear that we would have to be doing something that interrupts that transmission or that spread or that contagion, that we'd have to get more in there to prevent one event leading to another, and also to try to find out when an event might happen to try and, in a way, cut it off. That's where the violence interrupter piece of this came in. So there was a lot of conversation with people on the street while having simultaneous conversations with researchers who had tried various things.
Well, I'm imagining that in those many meetings that you had, even on your own staff, but certainly when you connect with neighborhood people, there was quite a bit of skepticism, quite a bit of saying, man, you just don't understand what is going to work and what you're dealing with here. Do you remember those kind of conversations?
Oh, my God, yeah. In fact, it's still going on. But then, we were told all kinds of things that were needed to be done in order to reduce violence. You're going to have to, improve the schools, improve the education, get the families to come back together again, get rid of the poverty. There are all of these conversations. And then there's a whole another set of conversations having to do with the guns, and we need to do that. And you're not going to succeed unless you, and then fill in the blank. All of these predisposing ideas. And then of course there's the whole other realm of, you need to really teach people a lesson, and we really need to crack down more. So all of the existing beliefs were, were not thrown away or given up, nor have they even to this day.
Dr. Gary Slutkin, let's talk about the interrupters. So just like in an epidemic, you hire people with special skills to reach the population with information and messages that could change behaviors that would stop the chain of the disease, of violence in this case, from continuing, stop the disease from spreading. So what skills for disease interrupters are common to all infectious disease work, and what were specialized to this disease of the spread of violence, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, Ebola is an interesting cousin to this problem. So, but I mean, in a way, so is HIV, AIDS, and others. The most important thing is who is selected as workers, so that the people who they're talking to trust them, so they have access and they to the people themselves in their homes, on the streets, rather than running away from these people. These are people who they already know and see them as part of their same kind of peer group, and they trust them, and they also know that they have, they're talking to them in their own interest. So if you have someone who's working on violence, you want to have people who come from the same subgroups, even not just same group. You know, they were in the same cliques or in the same gangs or in the same work, walk the same streets. Some of them are even cousins, or they know a lot of the people. So they are able to find out what happened at the party last night or who's upset about something. And, you know, in Ebola, these were people who were, you know, neighbors who were able to talk to people about, you know, well, it's not a good idea to be, you know, kissing and hugging your mom, even though she's dying and she's your mom. Well, that's a very hard thing to talk to someone, or, you know, to not be touching in burial, but to use it, do it in a different way. But that has to come from people who are really trusted by the people who you're talking with. So the first part of this is the selection of the health workers who are out there. And then, of course, what it is that you're training them in has to do with what are the behaviors that need to be changed. For Ebola, we just mentioned, you know, not touching some people who are sick. For violence, it's really, you know, helping to cool somebody down when they're angry and able to buy time, and then helping them to see it differently and to get socially, in a way, what we call off the hook, so they feel like they're still cool even though they didn't do it.
You call them, you know, credible messengers, and you've talked about the fact that they have to be trained in persuasion, buying time, and reframing, things that I gather that they are trained up in the program, but they also have to have some natural skills for those things. But oftentimes, these folks are people who have dabbled in crime and violence, ex-gangbangers and small-time drug dealers or more, in some cases, who have made a commitment to turn their lives around. But it's a very delicate balance of high-level skill and street experience often, isn't it?
You said it right. It's a delicate balance. But this is the world of epidemic control and the world of behavior change. It's actually the world of health. You know, we hire people who used to be involved in sex work to reach people who are now involved with sex work. We use people who were using drugs to if we're talking about changing drug use behaviors. But likewise, we use refugees to reach refugees and moms to reach moms. So the effect that we're using in workers who were previously involved in possibly violent situations themselves, it's not to do them a favor. It's because it's really the way the technology works. It's the way behavior change is really affected. It requires that the person who's trying to help you is someone who you trust. He gets who you are and where you're coming from, you know, how upset you are, what your thinking is. He talks the way you do, and he makes sense to you.
Gary, there was a documentary produced on this program back in 2011 as it was rolling out in Chicago by filmmaker Steve James. A lot of folks know him from his documentary Hoop Dreams, where you really see the challenge of the interrupters going into these hot zones of violence and trying to apply all these tools of patience and empathy and listening and logic to people who, in some cases, are just hopping mad. They've just had a family member killed or arrested. One scene with an agitated young man named Flamo We might be able to play a tiny bit of that scene, but he's streaming profanity. And at one point, he says to the fellows who are working with him, "What can you do for me? You're going to take me out to lunch, and we're going to talk it out." And the workers calmly say, "Well, yeah, that's right. When are we going to do that? Right now." And he says, "Let me put my gun up." And they eventually head out. Not sure what happens after that, but you know, these are scary moments. And they're going in with no tools of violence with them. These interrupters are trying to make peace. Now, you've seen these films and heard these stories. How do you feel when you hear them and see them actually taking place? And what makes you confident that it's still the right approach?
Well, the confidence comes really from, I mean, the cure violence method's in tremendous demand, primarily because it's saving mayors money, it's saving taxpayers money, and it's making neighborhoods safer. And the stories, you know, some of the stories are shown in the film Interrupters, and the stories one after another are amazing. But, you know, stories of the work of emergency medical technicians that go in and, you know, save someone's life when they're, you know, not breathing and just laying there, and they know what to do. You see, and that's the whole thing. These workers are very, very highly skilled. Like the scene you're talking about of Kobe interacting with Flamo in the film. I mean, Kobe has been in that situation hundreds of times, and so it may look like he's kind of, you know, ad hoc and kind of winging it. He can analyze it. Okay, he's hot, but he's not doing this and that. And I'm just, you know, keep him talking, validate what he has to say, you know, and also, you know, this isn't the first time that Kobe is meeting Flamo. They know each other. Kobe was sent because he's someone who Flamo already knows. So they can swear and yell, but Kobe isn't at risk.
In the film, I believe Flamo actually calls Kobe and says, "This is going down," suggesting that he needs or wants the help in a way.
Yeah, that's common. That's common. People, they call, and they call about themselves. They also call about their friends. You know, my friend is about to do an armed robbery, and you know, he's crazy, and they don't want to see their friend do this because they're afraid, you know, he's going to get hurt or he's going to have to go to prison or something, and he's only just come out. So they call us too. Moms call us. You know, there's a mom who her son was loading up weapons downstairs in the basement with the friends. She doesn't want to call law enforcement on her son, but she'll call us too. So yeah, but much of the neighborhoods will know the cure violence workers because we put our phone numbers out there and we've met them all. And so they will call when they need help. And Flamo needed help, not just about what he was going to do. His situation was a mess. You know, I don't know if his brother or a couple of his brothers were also arrested. His mom was mishandled and mistreated. And, you know, he was a mess. His family situation at the moment had really been disturbed. And it was like, what do I do? And we can help him without him making it worse, making bad choices.
Well, choice seems to be the key word there. It's like all of a sudden people in these desperate situations where they observe or feel themselves leaning toward violence, there's an option that's known in the community that wasn't there months or years ago.
That's right. What we've done is fill a gap, and it turns out to be an important gap of someone who the people in the community can trust, who can talk them down and prevent events from happening.
So, Gary Slutkin, what were the earliest results of trying this approach?
Well, the first time that we put what we now call a cure violence approach into a neighborhood, it was in West Garfield Park on the west side of Chicago, which at the time was the worst police district for killings in the country. And there was a drop of 67%. This was in the year 2000, a drop from 43 shootings and killings to 14. And it happened really fast. I mean, there was a 90-day period without any shootings, and then there was one, and then another 90-day period, and it was an immediate effect, which, by the way, is what the researchers have been finding over and over that there's an immediate effect that's highly impactful and immediate and sustained. So there was a 67% drop, and then, you know, our funders said, you know, well, that I was sure it wasn't a fluke, they're going to do it again, and we got 45% drop with a slightly lesser amount of the intervention over the next four communities. And then it was put into Chicago in a larger way, and the city as a whole went down by 25%. Still, only about 25% of the city was covered. And since then, there have been all kinds of replications in Baltimore and New York and Kansas City and Puerto Rico and South Africa and Mexico and Honduras and even in Iraq. So these kinds of numbers of 40%, 50%, 60% drops are fairly common now. And there have been multiple evaluations of the work, I should say. Justice Department, CDC, Hopkins have all done independent evaluations of the cure violence method. And it's, you know, it's fairly reliably effective at making a neighborhood safer. And, you know, and doing so without the arrest side effect, you know, just by helping people change. And then it even diffuses into next neighborhoods.
You can hear more from Dr. Gary Slutkin of Cure Violence, headquartered in Chicago, where they're learning to reduce violence by treating it like they would any infectious disease epidemic. Listen to either our complete original interview with him or just more of him in our hour-long version of the program. Head to peacetalksradio.com for all that. Next up, a conversation with former U.S. intelligence officer Ray McGovern, who prepared daily briefings for many presidents, both Republicans and Democrats. Since retiring in the early 90s, he's been an active commentator and critic of both Republican and Democratic presidential administrations. But he's also a keen historical scholar who visited our home base in Albuquerque on the anniversary of a 1928 international deal called the Kellogg-Briand Pact that attempted back then to make war illegal and an international crime.
A lot of people don't know about that moment in history. And when they find out about it, then there's a little bit of a disappointment, like, oh, well, that sounds like that would have been a good idea, but obviously the 20th, 21st centuries has not been paying much attention to it. Mm-hmm. Talk about why it still is a moment in history that's worth reflecting on, worth bringing back up.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking 1928, so about 10 years after the First World War. Wars of that magnitude have a way of lingering in their effects. And these folks, especially Frank Kellogg, who was Secretary of State, felt really strongly that given what had happened, World War I, and given the turbulence that everyone was sort of expecting in Europe, and the 20s was, and 23 especially, was a very turbulent time in Germany, for example, he sought a way to ban a war, pure and simple. Ends, you know, end, period. And he persuaded Briand, a Frenchman, to join him. The Frenchman wanted to delimit it a lot, but Kellogg stayed strong. And in the event, 83 senators voted for it, one voted against it. It was regarded as sort of the crest of the times. And as I mentioned, Kellogg won the Nobel Peace Prize the following year, 1929. 1929, a very auspicious year. But that betokens the universal respect that this man had, and the acceptance of the idea that we don't want to do another war. Now, other things intervened, of course, and it's much easier to do war than to make a lasting peace, and the terms exacted on the German people and created a fertile field for Hitler and his regime to come to power. One of the points I tried to make tonight or this afternoon was simply that he came to power, but there was no real resistance. People kind of watched as though from a box at the theater. And I see that happening in our country today.
Your intelligence career spanned over all these presidents, and then you've been engaged in watching the other presidential characters. And I'm just wondering which among them, if any, you know, seemed to you to be most driven toward peace and world affairs.
Well, that's easy. Jimmy Carter, a real respect for human rights, He did some bizarre things that everybody said couldn't be done. And he elicited a lot of laughstock from people who made fun of him, and I suppose had reason to make fun of the Georgia folks that he brought in with him. But his heart was in the right place. You could see that from what he did subsequently to his presidency. And had he not been sabotaged by the oil war and by the really underhanded deal that Reagan's people made with the Ayatollahs to keep those hostages until after the election. You recall there were 52 hostages that the Iranians stole from our embassy, put them in jail. There were negotiations all through that election year. Carter did everything he possibly could, including try to rescue them, and failed. And it became known on the day of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan that the Iranians were going to release them forthwith. And the investigative reporter for whom I work, Robert Perry, has written a book called The October Surprise, and he documents chapter and verse how Bobby Gates, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Casey met with the Iranians months before the election. Said, don't release them yet. Yeah, don't release them yet. And we guarantee if you release them on inauguration day, we're going to sell you a couple of things that we haven't been able to send you. Right? So it's really, yeah.
I mean, well, and Carter said at the beginning of his cancer struggle that his one regret was that he didn't send in a second helicopter because he thought he'd probably get reelected. If they hadn't run into the sandstorm and a second helicopter might have been able to free the hostages, would you agree with that assessment?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I think I like him, but I like to give Jimmy Carter the benefit of the doubt, but I think he's got a little wishful thinking that if he had sent one more helicopter, that would have changed history.
One of the great parlor conversations or online blog topics, and you brought it up today, is whether Barack Obama deserved the Nobel Peace Prize he was awarded in 2009. He seemed even embarrassed by it at the time. If you go online now, you're able to see articles that say he still hasn't earned it, that his steps with Cuba and Iran bring him a step closer. Where would you suggest that, so close to the end of his term, that Obama is going to land as a peacemaker at all in his administration?
Well, I confess to having been surprised by Barack Obama and John Kerry in sticking to their guns, so to speak, in the negotiations with Iran. They were, have been, and still are under extreme pressure from the Israel lobby, from all kinds of folks that do not want the Iranians to play their proper role in that part of the world. And they stuck to it. They got a terrific deal. I mean, what I've been saying in my lectures is this. Most Americans have no idea that 16 U.S. intelligence agencies decided, as they put it, quote, with high confidence, end quote, unanimously, back in 2007, they concluded that Iran had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. Whoa, and had not resumed work on that weapon. Now, that judgment came in 2007. It has been reaffirmed, reiterated every year since, okay? That does not mean they haven't been working on generating electricity through nuclear power. They're doing that in spades. But you need separate work to create a nuclear warhead. And we know that they haven't been doing that since the end of 2003, which is 12 years ago, okay? Now, so what does that say? It says to me, we have finally got on a piece of paper, an ironclad commitment from Iran to stop doing what we know they stopped doing at the end of 2003. And we're going to monitor it just as closely or more closely now. Now, that sounds funny, right? But if that's what it takes, that's all right. Yeah, this is a good deal. Let's do it. And let's get this bugaboo out of this relationship.
Peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution is the topic of our program. It's mm-hmm. what our listeners are tuning in for. What would you like to say to those people about engagement that seems probably hard for them to even imagine in their lives today?
Another good question. I would suggest that they take the time and energy that it does take to become better informed on what's going on. The best program that I advertise and that I watch 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, is Amy Goodman's democracynow.org. Then it really is incumbent upon people to realize that there is such a thing as too late. Then they need to visit their senators, their representatives. That means staying on beyond the time when they're welcome, stay on. And if you have gray hair like I do, be aware that you have a terrific advantage. I've been beat up a couple times by people simply for standing during a Hillary Clinton speech and simply for trying to see a public event with General David Petraeus in New York. Now, what happens? Well, there are cameras around, and it gets recorded. And what we learned specifically with respect to Hillary Clinton is that Americans just really don't like old people get beat up, okay? And so when Fox News came out with this first report that a 71-year-old veteran who was thought to have a megaphone or a sign that he would wave in the secretary's face and turned his back on her, or was thought to be about to shout something, he was escorted from the auditorium. Well, if you see the video, you see how I was escorted. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because people saw that national TV. People saw my Veterans for Peace shirt. They found out I was 71. And Hillary Clinton received thousands and thousands and thousands of emails and telephone calls. Why? Because Americans don't like to get to see people my age getting beat up. I'm being serious here. Young people, the attitude is, well, you got to come with them. But old folks like me, you know, so put your body into it. Take a leap of faith. Do some civil disobedience in a meaningful way. They might rough you up a little bit. They're not going to break your arm or kill you. And people will see that even people our age, or especially people our age, take this stuff seriously. And that we mean to speak out in our own way. And it's a big high, because when you do this with people who are as dedicated as you, you'll find a certain peace there that you would hardly imagine could exist. You find the affirmation of people that you respect, and you find that it's not about being successful. It's about being faithful, and that the good is worth doing because it's good.
To hear more of our interview with Ray McGovern, you can go to our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can go to hear all the programs in our series dating back to 2002 and find lots of other resources as well. It's also where to go to sign up for a monthly newsletter, the monthly podcast, or to make a contribution or vehicle donation to support the nonprofit work of Peace Talks Radio. Peace Talks Radio is produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated, separately and apart from your public radio station. Support also comes from the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.